Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to chat with steampunk author Justin Andrew Hogue about his novel Pacemaker. Welcome, Justin.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, sorry I put your middle name first.
That's okay. Nothing wrong with that at all.
Well, Princess Diana did it, so that's, I guess it's okay, right?
Yeah, why not? Makes it more British that way.
Yeah. Tell the audience a bit about yourself and your background.
Funny thing is, long before I decided to get into authoring books, I was actually in the graphic design and ad field. And really didn't come around until much later after college and after everything else, but I sat down one day and I decided I wanted to write working class novellas and try to get in the field just as a simple blue collar guy writing books for simple blue collar people.
That's interesting. Simple blue collar people. Well, that's most of us. we're all working people.
Well, yeah, and that's the biggest point in this series of novellas is that it emphasizes the original format of A Penny Dreadful, and that it's meant to be an escapist format for people who may know how to read but don't have time for it, or may not know how to read and are learning to make time for it. And that's why it's such a compact little read, and you can do it Amazon says you can read it in about 2.5 to 3 hours if you just sit straight through it. So it's about the length of a movie if you've got the time for it.
Yeah, the one thing I found interesting was there's no real page break or chapters. You explained it to me. Can you explain it to the audience exactly what it's styled out of and how you came up with this idea?
Well, there are no chapters and there are no major page breaks, but there are format changes. So there's usually just a double space separation, and then what's considered a new section begins on the indent. It's a lot like what a classic Penny Dreadful would do, because most Penny Dreadfuls didn't have chapters or page breaks. Because of the size that's required to do that, it was a money saver for them to make the story continuous. In turn, that format ended up influencing what was later known to become the American dime novel and comic books, things that did not have chapters or page breaks as well as it developed through history.
Interesting. Because I've seen copies of Strand Magazine and, you know, the old magazines, and they're formatted different. Those novels based on, because you said it was based, the dime novel became based on it and later comic books. How did they come about that they did it in this format? I mean, was it like, did they decide to do it like a newspaper? I'm just trying to figure out
most of the books were printed on the Victorian equivalent of recycled paper. In some cases, it would come on new paper if the people writing the Dreadful had money. In other cases, it was recycled from newspaper and bound loosely with the early equivalent of a staple. And in a lot of cases, it was just salvage paper that people would take from bookbinders. So no Penny Dreadful had the same size or format even, and that's what made it hard for a lot of these guys originally in the beginning, was that they had next to no money. It was a very revolutionary process because it was a way of trying to spread reading to the masses. Because back then, if you were going to get a large bound book, it would cost quite a bit of money. And in most cases, it would cost the equivalent of, you know, a family's night out, for dinner. And so these people turned around and they made it in such a way that they recycled, reused, and upcycled the paper and the products that they would get that was left over from the bookbinders, and they would clean it up as much as possible and then reprint over it and release it for a penny farthing.
Interesting. Do you know if it was part of the lending libraries that were very popular in Victorian England at that time, or was that something that was picked up at newsstands or at...
It was picked up at some newsstands, depending on the region that you were in. In a lot of cases, it was disseminated by the people that produced it. It was kind of like
fanzines were before the computer age.
yes, a lot like that. A group of people would hit you up at a convention and go, "Hey, have you read this yet? It costs this much." And essentially, the same thing would happen back then. There would be private vendors that were there just selling their dreadfuls on the street, and they would hand them out to people, and they go, "Here, read this." And in a lot of cases, it was really just to spread the idea that anybody could read. A lot of people that backed this in the beginning were people that thought that, you know, the ability to read would greatly excel your chances of succeeding in society. It was the first evolutionary step for man socially in the process of breaking the caste system that was reading, because back then, not many people could read or read very well. And it was really just relegated to those that were already in the cloth or people that were of power and money. And after the whole printing press came about and the idea that you could print just about whatever you wanted, more than just news and more than just the books that they said you could, they started printing these and handing them out wherever they could. They'd make a couple bucks off of it. And that would allow them to go out and print the next series, and then, you know, people would wait for it.
That's fascinating. It was the first steampunk I've ever read. It was very interesting. Kind of reminded me sort of Jules Verne, some of his books. Is this typical? Because, like I said, your book was the first steampunk I've ever read.
Well, the words typical and steampunk... It's a very interesting phrase to put those two together. You got it pretty close when you think about Jules Verne. Jules Verne is a major influence on steampunk writers, especially myself. I mean, I was in love with Jules Verne books as a child. But it can vary from person to person, group to group. Steampunk is really hard to define. As a good friend of mine, Lisa Vaca at San Diego Steampunk, says, everything is steampunk, and it's not steampunk to say that that's not steampunk. And I agree with her. I agree with her very much when she says that, because the world of steampunk is still new. You know, some of these written works and genres have been around for hundreds of years, but steampunk is starting to break out from science fiction as a subgenre. Yes, it's related to science fiction, and yes, it got its roots in science fiction, but where it's going is so vast that it needs to be on its own. And whether you're writing about steampunk, it could be just plain old cogs and gears and robots and steam, much in the case of my work, or then in other cases you have, you know, the supernaturals involved. And there's robots, and there's vampires, and there's zombies like Sherry Priest, and it varies quite a bit when you talk to people, because some people just like to dress up steampunk, and they'll tell you what steampunk is based upon the aesthetic and how they dress up as steampunk, and some people how they are just as readers, and how some people are as authors. I'd like to think that we're still in the undiscovered country phase of what steampunk is, for it really only being coined as a genre for less than 30 years.
Very interesting. I'm fascinated by the whole concept. I mean, I'd started to find out about it at some of the conventions. I had never read one. And I'd seen it on television and things, people talking about it. But your book was the first I read, and I kind of liked some of the concepts of your book. One of the things I love is, well, which all of steampunk obviously is based on, is Victoria. Are you a big history buff? Do you love history?
I absolutely adore history. I made it a point when I wrote this book that about 95% of the characters are all real. There's only one character in this first volume that is fictional, Mr. Sherman, and because I like to write characters based on people for a little bit of extra help, it's actually based on a good colleague of mine, G.C. Sherman, who's a writer as well, and I kind of use the way that he acts as a guide for manipulating the story. He's kind of an enhancement feature I use to pull things back and forth. So if you notice at times that it may seem as one author to another when you read another author's work and they're struggling to change things, he's my ability to change things. But going back to the point of history is that I love all of the amazing things that happen between the pages of history that nobody really pays attention to. And that was the biggest inspiration for Pacemaker. Some people are aware of the fact that Henry Babbage created the Difference Engine. It was the first attempt at a calculating computer, and he actually failed at it. And that was the bigger inspiration behind using the Difference Engine, was that he was only given 1,700 pounds back then to finish a working Difference Engine, which, I mean, equivalent to today's money, was about $750,000, I mean, give or take, depending on the rate at the time. But that's, I mean, when you look at the size and scale of a computer like that, it's a phenomenal task, and that's why he didn't get it right for another two computers. So I posited the idea that he didn't finish it because he turned around and he used it for himself because he had the money, but the Crown didn't have the money to give him to finish the computer, so he kept it to himself. And he called on the help of Ada Lovelace, and which most people forget about her. The funny thing is when people they see my book on the table at conventions and stuff, and they go, "Lovelace, Lovelace," like the lady in the skin films in the 70s. And I go, no. Once upon a time, long before all that, there was a lovely young lady who was the world's first female programmer. And I was just absolutely fascinated with her. I mean, especially like as a teenager, I was really big into computer programming as a kid. And I remember getting an anniversary edition of Unix Magazine, and her painting was on the cover, you know, and said, "The Mother of Invention, Enchantress of Numbers." And I just, like, I swooned. It was one of those few circumstances where you see a painting from over 100, 200 years ago, and you fall in love with that person in the picture. And mine was Ada Lovelace, just because
so
there was the brain on her.
So it was like somewhere in time.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just immediately just, I was enamored by her. And when the idea came about to write this story, I knew that she had to be at the forefront of it. It is an ensemble in the beginning, but it will take over and become her story as it grows. And I'm so caught up in her life and in the short life that she had, because she died at the age of 36. So I'm really trying to keep within the confines of her actual life term. And still trying to do all these fascinating things.
Why did she die so young? Was it consumption or something?
It was a urinary tract infection.
Oh,
yeah. Painful. I mean, but back then in the 1830s, I mean, this was a time and place where they still hadn't completely figured out that, milk wasn't good for transfusions and you should be using actual human blood. So, I mean, we were still doing bloodletting back then and, you know, cutting things off just to save the rest of the body. So it's easy to think that a urinary tract infection could kill anybody back then.
Sad. Very sad.
Yeah.
I know you're a reader, but what kind of books do you like? What is it just steampunk, or do you like science fiction, or do you like mystery, or
I love science fiction. I'm actually a sucker for a good romance novel. There's always, John Irving's latest on my desk, especially since it gives me something good to talk about with my sisters. But I prefer not. I'm outnumbered at home. All the women I grew up with, women I quote, because I was always the only boy at home. So. My mother's house was covered in Danielle Steele novels when I was a child. My sister, Danielle, is named after Danielle Steele for that fact. I think the biggest book I read by the time I was 10 was Zoya. And I have no shame to say that, you know what, that she did have a good influence on my life with some of those, because not a lot of guys really take the time to understand the nature of love, whether it's familial between two people or carnal between two people. And romance writers like Danielle Steele really covered that base, whether it's in her early work, in her short novellas, or even in her long-form ones that she's most famous for now. But, you know, it would behoove the science fiction writers that are men out there, if they really wanted to understand the human condition of love, take the time to read a saucy romance novel every now and then. But when I'm not reading those, I prefer to read nonfiction. I'm usually trying to discover the next new piece of history that I can actually change, because the biggest part after volume two is that my timeline completely changes in my book universe, and I start manipulating the events of history. This first book's more of an introduction to the characters, and then as the readers ease in, I'm going to slowly take them on a ride of changing major events that they'll recognize, and then using some minor events that nobody ever knew about because they just don't make it to your history class anymore.
Yeah, that is so true. It's sort of sad to me. One of the things that I remember when I was a kid, and this is going to sound sort of stupid, but I loved Bewitched. I loved the show Bewitched. And in my history book, when I was in junior high school, I couldn't wait till we finally got to Salem and the witch trials and all that stuff, because I grew up watching the show. You know, it was one sentence. It was one sentence. They gave more history on a TV show, and true history on a TV show, than they did in history class.
And it hasn't changed much since the time that you went to school. I mean, I remember the most that I got about Salem was about a page or two, and then we'd end up reading fiction based on the time, and we'd read The Crucible and act it out on stage and stuff like that, and that was... But I was always miffed about history earlier on, because I really liked westward expansion as a kid, especially growing up in a family with such Western influence. I thoroughly enjoyed the idea of taking the westward trails. And my favorite just unsung hero of history was Zebulon Pike, and because he had the opposite job of Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark were supposed to find the Northwest Passage, and the United States government sent Zebulon Pike to find the Southwest Passage. And as we all know, Lewis and Clark found nothing, but they cataloged everything, and they came back with lots of information. Mm-hmm. What we really don't hear about is that Zebulon Pike found everything, but he got captured by Spanish conquistadors, spent 3 months in prison, and then walked home with only like 10 pages hidden in his musket. So everybody just went, well, it's a win, but it's still a failure because you didn't come back with your work. So.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, it sucks when the dog actually eats your homework.
It's just, no, I don't, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's about the way history works a lot.
Look at
Paul Revere.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Revere.
Well, and that's
a perfect example.
And that's why I think that's what leads me back to loving steampunk is so much, is that it favors the unsung the most. Yeah, especially since feminism was a developing thing in the Victorian era. But even more so in steampunk fiction, that feminism is emphasized to a point to where it really thinks about how does society grow if men and women are treated equally, because it really does make an impact. And I think that's why a lot of these people have the ability to concept a world so utopian based upon all these ideas, because thinking in the mindset of the 21st century, of men and women can do it together, and all classes and races can do it together. And that was the one element that really the Victorian age, if it would have had it, I think that would have put us
changed the world
centuries ahead of where we are today. And that's why, again, why I love the genre so much, is because it really does change the world when you think about it. Those simple interactions of letting a young girl pick up a wrench because she wants to, You know, and that's mm-hmm. what I thought was so intriguing about Ada Lovelace, because she was the daughter of Lord Byron, famous poet. She was actually one of the only legitimate children he had. And her mother was just so furious that she was eccentrically following in her father's footsteps. And he encouraged it, because as far as he was concerned, that was his heir, so why not do what you want to do? You know, he knew that he was on the verge of a new age, you know, especially for being the quiet feminist that he was, because it really, there weren't that many male feminists back then, but Lord Byron was one, John Stuart Mill. There were quite a few inventors as well that were behind the idea of, you know, sooner or later all of us guys are going to run out of ideas. We might as well ask a woman, because a woman might actually know the answer.
Well, Byron was rather revolutionary anyway.
It was very.
In everything.
Very. Yeah.
Would you like to let the listeners, who are readers,
mm-hmm.
give them a taste of what you would like them to take away from your story? Not a reading, but just explain what it is, what's the kernel of what the idea of your story is that you want them to take away from it.
Well, the biggest part is that anybody can read the book. There are a few bumps here and there where you might have to pick up a dictionary if you're a new reader. But the biggest part I've enjoyed so far is my youngest reader is 9 years old, and my oldest reader is 87. What I'd like to note at more in between that, one of my oldest readers, he's not as old as 87, but his name is Shannon, and he hasn't picked up a book since high school. He just reads the paper, he'll read the comic strips, but he has been your blue-collar, I go to work every morning at 4 a.m., punch the clock, and I use an excavator and I dig a hole every day. And when he heard that I wrote a book, because we're good friends, he was like, you know what, I'm actually going to try to finish this. I don't read books, but I'm going to finish this. And 2 weeks later, I saw him in passing, and he knocked me over. And he's like a third of my size. He nearly knocked me over and goes, I want to know what happens to Henry. First time you get me to read in over 35 years, and I want to know what happens to a character. I've never been invested so much before, he said.
Aww.
And that was when I realized that the book had actually served its purpose. I mean, I will enjoy the day when, you know, people can talk about the characters and revel in the fantasy of it. But the biggest goal that I want to reach with this book was what the Penny Dreadful did, was they got people to read. You know, there's not enough love to read anymore. That was the biggest reason why Reading Rainbow got pulled off the air, you know, recently. That there's not enough people that love to read. So everybody's going back to the fundamental teachings of reading. So it's, you know, core values and concepts of reading. We got to teach everybody to read again, because not everybody knows how to read. But I really feel that in order to get someone to read, you have to give them something that they can or want to read. And that's why I think the Penny Dreadful and the American Dime novel can actually make a good return, because their formats lead the reader to have to constantly push forward. The big reason behind no chapters is that as you read, you have to pick a stopping point. You don't know where the thought's going to end, because everything is fluid. It's meant to keep you going. It's meant to push you along, and then sooner or later you turn around and go, I've read 60 pages. Well, there's only 40 more. Let's do it. Let's make it to the end. You know, and so if there's anything that I really like to share with the listeners is that if you haven't thought about picking up a book in a long time, give it a chance, just at the fact that it might get you to finish a book for once. It's not a hard read. It's meant to be something that gives you just enough to imagine and just enough to escape as a Penny Dreadful should, and hopefully it will encourage you to read more.
I'll tell you, I had a great deal of hope about readers when Harry Potter started becoming a phenomena, because everybody's crazy over it.
And then when she stopped writing
the books, it was like...
Well, you know, great stories have to end sooner or later. I mean, but that's why I just had to think about, you know, 20 more stories after I'm done with Ada and Henry. So which
well,
that's a long story for another
time. Thinking of doing another series, but I'm just like, well, why aren't you going to another
Everybody wants Harry
book?
Back, yeah. And I will agree with that because I was a Harry Potter fan for the longest time. You know, as much as I like to dig on Twilight, I will have to say I got people to read, and that's far more important than any trifling issue that I can have with someone, because you know, it may not have been my slice of pie, but at least you know, it was a slice that people were reading, and that's the important part.
Yeah, that's another thing. Was Twilight? Not my favorite either. My personal thing is I'm not a big. I don't like vampires that much.
I like vampires,
really,
but I'm picky about my vampires.
What?
I said I'm picky about my vampires.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I was really just happy that kids were reading it. It's like, oh, my gosh, this is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I want. I remember sitting at one of my offices, and I'm reading during my break, sitting at my desk, and they're saying, what are you doing? And I go, reading a book. And they're like, well, why? You could be playing a game or something. And I'm like, because I have much more fun reading a book than you do with them telling you what to think and to dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, went right over their head.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of sad. Is that why you'd start writing your book? For people like that?
Yes, that was one of the biggest reasons, was just pushing that want to read, and you know, giving them something to rally behind if they continue reading. And so far, I mean, Pacemaker's set to be a 15-book series, and it will tie into the rest of the universe. I mean, after we leave Ada and Henry, it will move on. And I actually intend after this to write about Mary Shelley, just because she had a really good relationship. With Lord Byron, who is Ada's father, and then that's kind of like a side series, just to have a little fun for a while and relax my brain. But afterwards, I intend on expanding the universe more and dealing with, you know, more of American side of culture and hopping back across the pond and going on some adventures with Calamity Jane. And then my favorite after that, I'm in the middle of concepting a short series about Hawaii and trying to get it right between the steampunk and diesel age and creating an entire fictional version of Hawaii and following the abdication and the fall of the crown of Hawaii and try to give it its own independence, because that's what I've always dreamt about is what would happen. Where would I be today if, you know, Hawaii still had a monarchy? And so being... Being Hawaiian myself, it was always something I was always interested about. So I'm having a lot of fun with figuring out how to change the rules for a world where Hawaii is on its own.
So what are you working on now? Are you working on your series? Or are you working on the Mary Shelley book?
I'm primarily working on Pacemaker. Pacemaker is my big objective for the next year and a half. And then I'll work on the Mary Shelley books. You know, I write pieces here and there. I like to write in a web because things are interconnected, especially in this series of Dreadfuls. The outlook so far is I'm looking at nearly 80 in the series by the time I'm done. But and they're all fleshed out. I finished my concepting about, you know, 3 or 4 months ago. Everything down to the last book so far, and it just keeps looking like I'll add things, but I don't know until I actually finish writing each book as it goes. My biggest thing right now is actually Dreadfully Punk. I actually started an author blog co-op. I wouldn't really call it an e-zine. I really wouldn't call it just a blog, and so I like to tell people it's a blog co-op. Three other authors and I, G.C. Sherman, who I mentioned earlier, Lady Lamb, and Kenneth Stewart, we came together on the weird idea that, hey, why don't we just, let's just create an author's hub together. And so we write about steampunk, some of them write about cyberpunk, dieselpunk, and we just kind of made it a place for, you know, punk authors to hide up and write their stories. Every Friday we write flash fiction, and we choose a theme every week, and we have guest authors occasionally on the site. And then in between that, it's really just trying to connect with the steampunks of San Diego. SDSteampunk.com has definitely helped me out in connecting with everyone. Jeff and Lisa Vaca, who are just absolutely amazing people to know in the San Diego steampunk scene, have really opened my eyes to the people that are steampunk in my local area. And because of such, I got to meet such amazing people like Kim and Linda Hustle at the House of Hustle and the Starburner Intergalactic Courier Service. And just knowing these people and getting to spend time with them and learn about it has really opened my mind even more about steampunk.
Cool. We're out of time. I just wanted to know, do you have any events coming up?
Actually, for those listeners that are in the San Diego area, on Sunday, July 20th in Oceanside, we'll be at Heritage Park in Oceanside. That's behind the old Mission San Luis Rey. And we're going to have a steampunk picnic afternoon, and that'll be hosted by Dreadfully Punk and Grand Pacific Steam, a new group that's come in, and they're trying to really help connect steampunks. So far, we've got a good amount of RSVPs. These picnics usually do pretty well. People come out, they bring their own tea, they bring their own food, and we hang about. There's going to be music, there's going to be food, there's going to be a root beer float stand, which I thoroughly love. But yeah, that'll be that July 20th, and then the whole week of Comic-Con after that, all the steampunks that I know and the who's who of steampunks, whether it be Drake and McTrowell or SD Steampunk or the House of Hustle, will be all over Comic-Con with on-site and off-site events.
Cool. We'll have your website on my blog, so anything that's popping up will appear on my blog. I want to thank you for a really great interview. I hope you enjoyed it.
I had a really good time today, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
Oh, thank you. I was happy to have you. Next week, we're going to have Carrie Thompson, and she's going to talk about her novel, Mirror X. I'd like my live audience to thank Justin for a really great interview. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Sherry.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.